Hello and welcome to Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio. Big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. I'm your aptly named host. Our listener of the week is Aubrey Bergauer. She's executive director of the California Symphony. She tweeted, "Loved this episode. I listened a second time and took notes." She was talking about the March 25th show this year on lead and matching gifts and corporate matching gifts. She's at Aubrey YY. That's Aubrey with two extra Y's on the end. Thank you very much for loving Nonprofit Radio, Aubrey. Congratulations on being our listener of the week. Oh, I'm glad you're with me. I'd grow a gibbous if you backed me into the idea that you missed today's show. How we got here. Features of today's charitable community emerged from clear points in history. How did women come to outnumber men in the sector? Why is the Northeast dominant? Dr. Robert Penna returns to reveal the formation of our modern charity complex. His book is The Nonprofit Outcomes Toolbox. And new overtime rules. The U.S. Department of Labor has issued new rules for classifying which employees are eligible for overtime. They're effective December 1st, so you need to know what's up. Who's got your back? Gene Takagi, our legal contributor and managing attorney of the Nonprofit and Exempt Organizations Law Group, NEO. On Tony's Take Two, Fundraising Fundamentals Roundup, we're sponsored by Pursuant, full-service fundraising, data-driven, and technology-enabled. You'll raise more money, Pursuant.com. My pleasure to welcome Dr. Robert Penna back to the studio. He's author of the book, The Nonprofit Outcomes Toolbox, which first brought him to the Nonprofit Radio studio in September 2011. He's been a consultant to Charity Navigator and has presented in Canada, Africa, the Middle East, Europe, and Australia. Nothing in the Antarctica, though, I see. He grew up in the Bronx, lives in Wilmington, North Carolina, and knows more about DC Comics characters than an adult should admit. You'll find Robert Penna at OutcomesToolbox.com. Bob, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Pleasure. Thank you for hustling your way to the studio today.
Yeah, the train was late.
I understand, but you were not. You saved it. Nonprofit Outcomes Toolbox. Last time you were here was 5 years ago. How's the book doing?
It had just come out. It's been phenomenal, as you said.
Yeah, was that just released, 2011?
It was released in 2011. Okay. Yes, it was about 90 days or 60 days before I was here. It's gotten me all over the world. The response has been incredible.
Not Antarctica, though.
But not Antarctica. The penguins and the puffins are not particularly interested, I guess, in the performance. But the good news is that word has been spreading that there's nothing else like it out there for nonprofits that want to learn how to be performance-based and really start working on outcomes. And it's got me all around the world, places I never ever thought I'd get to see. Saudi Arabia, Nairobi, Australia. It's been phenomenal.
Outstanding. So international organizations are interested in outcomes measurement as well?
The United States actually is the leading nonprofit sector in the world. Okay. Everybody looks to see what we're doing. And so when nonprofits started looking at outcomes here, nonprofits in other parts of the world started looking as well. And so I got invitations, and there I was.
Excellent. Love it. Okay. I'm glad it's doing well.
I'm even happier than you are.
Residual check. Finally.
Oddly enough.
The checks are pouring in, finally.
Yeah, the first one came.
All right. First one? Takes 5 years?
Depends upon how big your advance is. You have to work off the advance.
Oh, I see. All right.
But all right. I finally did.
Okay. I don't want to get the details about your personal finances. All right.
There's not much to talk about.
That'll be a short subject. We have to fill 25 minutes. But we're going to, because we're going to talk about the history of the charitable sector,
right,
which is a part of a new book.
Part of a new book.
That you're working on. So expose us to what the new book is. It's not out yet.
It's not out yet.
Yeah, what's that going to be about?
The new book is basically a donor's guide. It really is basically what you should know about the sector. Every year, we individual Americans give billions of dollars. Last year was $278 billion just from us. And most of us know nothing about the sector. And so I am, depending upon the metaphor you choose, I'm either lifting the curtain or lifting the fig leaf. And we all know what usually hides behind the fig leaves.
All right. A fig leaf. I prefer that metaphor. All right.
Okay.
So when is that? You have a big fat advance that you're working on now?
Yeah. I'm working on a big fat advance. I really can't tell you because the book is. I'm trying to do a very, very thorough job. And there's an awful lot that we're going to talk about today. It's just some of it. Today we're going to be talking about the history part.
Right. This is not. It's not a history book.
No, I understand.
This is one chapter. I think, right?
Yeah, one piece of the book.
Okay.
So.
All right. So let's.
Just delve into it.
Okay. Let's go back to. Old England, which is where our charitable sector started with Queen Elizabeth I. What was going on under her fig leaf?
Oh, don't do that to me. Charity, as we think of it, was vastly different back then. It was virtually all individual, but it was not really designed to help the poor. The old Christian idea was that by the act of being charitable, the person who was being charitable got some sort of divine grace. Giving charity had nothing to do with ameliorating poverty or helping the poor. It was, I'm doing this so I will get good graces. Most of the poor laws had to do with trying to corral and chase the poor from place to place to place. But there were also a divergence of opinion as to really what was charity. And so what Elizabeth did was she did there was an act, a royal act in 1601, the Charitable Uses Act, and what she did in one fell swoop was she secularized charity, because in addition to the usual type things, poor, the needy, the infirm, the aged, she now included as perfectly valid charitable uses things like building roads, building bridges, building causeways, supporting the troops. If you donated money to raising an army, that was considered charity.
Yeah.
Things that you might consider to be almost social engineering, a fund for the marriage of poor maidens, because in those days you needed a dowry. If you had no dowry, your chances of being married were even lower. So this was a fund for the dowries of poor maidens so they could get married. There was charity was seen to be also the encouragement and the support of young learning artisans and artists and things of this nature. So what she did at that point was expand the concept of charity beyond the usual idea of helping an individual or helping individuals, and more towards what you and I would consider efforts of public benefit, public good. And that strain has never left us.
Okay. And also some elements of social engineering.
Yes.
Helping single women get married.
Yes.
You said moving the poor around. Moving the poor around.
That was the poor laws. We don't want to talk about that. Was not very nice. That was rather cruel.
No.
But this was in terms of helping young artisans, helping young artists, supporting them, supporting young academics. All of these were included in the list. Had never been thought of as charity before. Thereafter, yes.
Okay.
So and this part of explains, if I can just finish, why today you can have the opera, you can have a bird sanctuary, and you can have a battered women's shelter, all considered charities.
Charity. Yeah.
Because going back to Elizabeth, all of these secular things became part of charity.
Okay. Now we have just a minute before a break. Yeah. We brought this concept over with us, the Puritans, I should say. I'm an Italian, so I didn't bring it over. We brought something else over. But Puritans brought these concepts with them.
Yes, they did.
Yes,
but they also brought some. They also had some very, very important individual ideas of their own. I'm not quite sure if we have the time to go into it right now, but I can go over just over the top. Number one, it was every person's responsibility to take care of his neighbor. That was your duty to God, and that was your duty to the community.
Okay, cool.
Secondly, very, very important thing. The Puritans, unlike anyone else who came to North America, had the sense that they could use the law to enforce changes in attitude and behavior. So if we're talking about moral standards here, we're not talking about thou shalt not kill. We're talking about ideas towards social behavior. Their idea of a city on the hill, their idea of the New Jerusalem, they were going to create a better society. And if you wanted to live there, you had to fall in line 100%. We always see these pictures of them wearing dark clothes, etc. All of this was enforced by law. We can get back to it after the break.
Okay. All right. Well, we're going to move on from the Puritans, actually, because I want to start talking about some of our features of charity today.
Okay.
And we only have 25 minutes.
Okay.
And okay. So we're going to look at some of what characterizes charity today and how we got here. That's what it's all about. Stay with us.
You're tuned to Nonprofit Radio. Tony Martinetti also hosts a podcast for the Chronicle of Philanthropy. Fundraising Fundamentals is a quick 10-minute burst of fundraising insights published once a month. Tony's guests are expert in crowdfunding, mobile giving, event fundraising, direct mail, and donor cultivation. Really, all the fundraising issues that make you wonder, am I doing this right? Is there a better way? There is. Find the Fundraising Fundamentals Archive at TonyMartinetti.com. That's MARTIGNETTI. Remember, there's a G before the N. Thousands of listeners have subscribed on iTunes. You can also learn more at the Chronicle website, philanthropy.com. Fundraising Fundamentals, the better way.
Welcome back to Big Nonprofit Ideas for the Other 95%. This is our 295th show. The 300th show is coming up on July 29th. That's the 6th anniversary of Nonprofit Radio. July 29th, very special show. Hope you're with us. Okay, Bob.
I'm ready.
So I want to look at some features of charities today. Like, and this has relationship to the Puritans, the Northeast. So first explain, how is it that we characterize the Northeast as being dominant in charity philanthropy?
It's not the Northeast is dominant. It's New England culture is, in other words, you have to go, again, I hate to do this, you have to go back to the Pilgrims.
Right.
The idea of creating a better society. The Pilgrims, this was their one of their founding ideas. You and I had chatted briefly before about the split between charity and philanthropy. Where do these two split?
Yeah.
Well, one of the things that happened is that when philanthropy started developing, that Protestant strain of creating a better society informed what they were doing. And that has never changed. Most people would agree today that in terms of its humanistic goals, in terms of the kinds of things that it embraces, that more or less the nonprofit sector truly has a sort of a liberal cast or a liberal bent. I don't mean this to be political,
yeah,
but in terms of the things that it embraces, those all go back to creating that better society that started with the Pilgrims and through the 1800s, through the organized benevolence that they spread. This stuff was not down south. Down south, they had a totally different kind of culture. This all came from the Northeast. When you look at the nonprofit sector today, you're looking at the direct descendants of the organized beneficence of the Northeast, going back to the 1800s.
Okay. And today, we see just concentrations of charities in the Northeast.
But you always did. As early as 1820, there were over 2,000 of these voluntary associations in New England alone, vastly outstripping the numbers any place else.
Yeah. Americans have a penchant for creating associations.
De Tocqueville talked about.
You have a quote in the chapter from De Tocqueville.
Yes, De Tocqueville talks about that, and he says any place in Europe where you see a great man at the head of some endeavor, or in France the government, in the United States you will find an association, and that he wrote that in 1830.
Yeah, and the associations became nonprofits.
Our nonprofits,
and we're going to talk about how we got there through laws and recognition and et cetera. Okay, all right. What about women?
That's a very interesting one.
I think 60% of the employees in nonprofits are women. Do I have that roughly right?
It's probably more than that. And several women friends of mine would point out that a shameful number of directors are actually women. The staffs are overwhelming. When I speak in front of groups, very often there'll be 100 people in the room and there'll be like 4 males, honestly. That's normal. Where did this start?
Yeah.
This actually was in the early decades of the 1820s. You have to, again, think about the society. Due to the social mores of the day, women were not allowed to do
1820s. They weren't even voting.
Well, they weren't voting. They weren't working. Certainly the middle class and upper class women were not working. However, this was a Victorian era that had this notion that women were more sensitive, that women had a more perceiving eye. There was also something very, very important going on in the male world, and that was the beginning of what we call today contract theory. It changed working relationships, created the world we think of in terms of Dickens.
What do you mean it's contract theory?
We write it down, I owe you nothing past what's in the contract, and if I fire you, I don't owe you anything. It changed working relationships throughout Europe, and it hit the United States the Northeast particularly, the East Coast particularly, in the very late 1700s, early 1800s. It began to change the relationships amongst people, amongst neighbors, amongst merchants and the people with whom they did business.
Yeah.
Life got very, very sharp, hard-angled, and different, and almost say cruel, as opposed to how it had been. Women started to see, in ways that men refused to recognize, the downside of this, you know, hyper-capitalism and the crass commercial world. Every other avenue was closed to them, but this was not. They started pushing for, as early as 1795, women were behind the idea of pushing for penal reform. I had a list here I could have looked at, but they were against war. They were against press gangs. They were against dueling. They were against inebriation. They were against the abandonment of children. One thing that was a big issue throughout the 1800s was women being, shall we say, wooed, seduced, and abandoned. There were numerous groups. But if you look back, as early as 1795 was the first formal women's association for social betterment. Again, I have the name somewhere in my notes here. We don't need the name. But the point is, it goes back to 1795.
Yeah.
And by the early decades of the 1800s, 1810s, 1820s, this movement was almost entirely driven by women.
So the associations.
These associations, yeah, that were geared towards social betterment. Now, there were associations. There were associations of fishermen. There were the Granges. Those were not female dominated, but
those were more industry related.
Those were more male dominated because they had to do with the trades.
Trades, right? Right, because the men were doing the work.
Think about it. Abolition. Where was the capital of abolition? It was Boston. It certainly wasn't down south.
Yeah.
And yes, there was a gentleman whose name escapes me who ran the paper, but most of his field troops, the shock troops, were women.
Abolition, suffrage, yep.
Temperance. Carrie Nation?
Yeah.
These were all women driven, and there's many, many, many more, particularly when it gets around the child welfare and abandoned women, orphans, widows, help the prisoners. All reformed prostitutes.
And you mentioned prostitutes. Okay,
prostitutes.
But not only help for prisoners, but penal reform.
Penal reform.
They recognized the cruelty of the institutions.
Well, actually, you know, they thought the institutions were better than what preceded it, which included the pillory, the stock, and public whipping and branding. And so they thought the penitentiaries were better than that. And so they were pushing initially for jails rather than pillories, stocks, whipping, and branding.
Oh, okay. That is penal reform?
Yes,
is
compared to what had been.
Okay, yes. All right. I thought, so they didn't move out of the prison system.
They were trying to improve the prison system, away from whipping, branding, and
all right, so
tars and feathers.
So there was, so it really emanated from the women recognizing the softer side of life.
Actually, no. They were very shrewd.
Well, and preferring it over contract theory.
They capitalized contract upon emergence. Males' perception that they had a softer side. They were very shrewd. They knew what they were doing. They were soft, and they had these flowery ideas that just happened to work. They knew exactly what they were doing. But the thing was that the male population stepped aside because it deferred to what it saw as women's keener insights. In other words, they weren't playing. They might have been playing the gender card, but they did it very, very, very intelligently. They got what they want. They had their male allies when it came to having people write checks. DeWitt Clinton, former mayor of New York, he was the mayor of New York and the head of one of the biggest social improvement societies in the city at the same time. But it was all being run by these were the women, sisters, and daughters of the ruling male elite. And basically, what they did was they used the ruling male elite to get money for their efforts.
The men had it.
Yeah.
Okay. See, I think that's cool.
I think it's very cool.
Anything you want to say about women? How they emerged as dominant? Or
well, as the century continued, it's very, very interesting because
dominant in numbers, I should say.
Right.
I mean, there are a good number of women CEOs, executive directors, but a very small proportion of the 1.1 million charities or so. Are led by women.
What is very, very, very interesting is the way that they kept being resurgent. There was a move towards the early 20th century, which would have replaced a lot of them with male managers who were thought to be much more scientific. But when the sector got into trouble, and when I say not into trouble, not that it did anything wrong, but it suddenly found its raison d'etre questioned, not to mention its sources of funding.
Yeah.
It was the women who came back and were able to answer the need when the sector moved to the middle class as its salvation. And this was after the war. This was an era when the nonprofits had what we call nonprofits today. They weren't called that then. They really had no idea what they were going to do. I mean, a lot of them, there weren't that many of them, but they were starving. They were drying up on the vine, and they didn't know really what to do with themselves. And it was literally women who saved them by virtue of thinking in terms of things like family counseling and marriage counseling.
This is around the new. This is
1940s, 1950s.
Okay. And we're seeing this. So I guess another area that I want to cover is services to the middle class.
Yes.
And it emerged around the New Deal when New Deal legislation sort of
the New Deal
captured the poor away from the associations.
The New Deal, people think in terms of the New Deal as a couple of things. They think of the WPA, they think of the CCC, they think of highways being built and things like this. But they did an awful lot more because they were not just laborers and construction people that were out of work. They were thinkers, they were artists, they were musicians. And so under some of the New Deal programs, an awful lot of these people were hired and they provided services. They provided things, for example, there was one course that really interested me, how to teach people to think critically. And so they were offering this for free, public expense. But what was very interesting is that when, after the war, the public, particularly the middle class, liked a lot of these services. Also, think about it. In the earlier days, you really couldn't talk about marital problems. That was very private. You sure as heck couldn't talk about sexual problems. You really couldn't talk about having problems rearing your young, because in the earlier days, it was supposed to be the male had a strong hand, spare the rod, not the child, you know, spare the rod, spoil the child, etc. It was only after the war that these things started to become things people could talk about. It was the salvation in many cases of a lot of these nonprofit agencies, because what they started doing was providing specifically these kinds of services to the middle class. Interestingly enough, one of the rationales was the middle class could pay for it, at least in part. It didn't have to all be free.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You have to understand that a lot of the agencies that you think of now, things like Community Chest, they really and truly, number one, wanted to get away from relief. The experience of the Depression and the New Deal, when they'd been pushed out of relief and forced to find other ways to survive,
yeah,
had really gotten them to the point where they did not want to be back in the relief space, which was really seen as a descendant of charity. They were much more comfortable in the benevolence, the philanthropy, the betterment of society kinds of efforts, and they
rather than charity.
Yeah. So we talked about that before, the division between charity.
Yeah, and we didn't get into detail. We're going to,
but
yeah,
this is where they were much more comfortable, and that led them directly in the path to be ready for when eventually came along Great Society, etc., like that.
Okay. Now, is this the beginning of the divergence between charity and philanthropy?
The beginning of the divergence was actually in the 1800s.
Okay. What was the history of that?
The history of that was looking back, we think we have this picture of this very bucolic America, you know, from the colonial era. Most people don't even realize all the things that happened, say, from 1800 to 1840. And we sort of jump from George Washington to the Civil War. But an awful lot happened.
Yeah, but like you'd be in the wilderness if you went to beyond Philadelphia.
That was true, but an awful lot of things was happening. And one of the things that was happening was that the cities were growing. New York City was growing exponentially. You had a lot of immigrant groups coming in. You had, but also think about it, the older areas of New England, Massachusetts, etc., these have been farmed out. That was never great soil to begin with. The Ohio Valley was opening. People were moving. The tightness of the, we all have this kind of notion of Sturbridge Village and the cute little Yeah, that existed at one point. But by the time 1800 rolled around, a lot of that was changing. So that whole idea of direct community responsibility for charity was breaking down. Secondly, when you got to the cities had anonymity, and that alone attracted a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
There was the structures that had created charity before and allowed upon which charity had been based before were breaking down tremendously, number one. Number two, the numbers were increasing. And the idea was that charity was a waste. It was a waste of time. Charity comes from the Latin word careris, which means tenderness, mercy, and love. Philanthropy comes from the Greek, which means love of mankind. As early as 1704, it was recognized as a term meaning somebody who was interested in the public good, in public works, in public benefit. Right? They started looking not to help Tony or Bob because we had problems, but rather, why are the problems that Tony and Bob facing exist?
Now, when did this thinking start?
This thinking started by 1810, by 1820.
Early. 18,
very, very okay. early. Yeah. It was also seen as much more organized and much more scientific, right? Whereas...
Right, we can help the masses rather than one person at a time.
But they weren't...
If we can get to the causes...
Exactly. What they were looking to do was create
poverty,
that better... Go back to
addiction,
the
et cetera.
Tony, go back to the Puritans. Create a better society. Why do we have poverty? All right. Now, their answer in many cases was very stilted. Their answer was, if only the poor would act more like us.
All right.
Yeah, that is true.
Not very helpful.
No, it isn't very helpful. But it was for an awful long time, that was the answer. It was a whole period called the Friendly Visitors who went into places down like Five Points. And basically, the message is, if only you would be more like us. However, even though they were misfiring because they didn't have the knowledge we have today, they didn't have the theory today, they certainly didn't have computers where they could crunch numbers, their idea was this benevolence. The idea was they were trying to change society, not necessarily help people. So that was the division between charity, which has always been direct and specifically focused on individual family, and philanthropy, which is always had much broader goals and has always been much more abstract. But that split, literally, Tony, goes back to the early decades of the 1800s.
Wow. Okay, cool. Let's move forward a little bit to some of the recognition in the tax laws.
That's really interesting.
Now, we only have like 2 minutes left, so,
okay, so
we're going to have to go through this a little quickly. Charities, there was first nonprofit status. Was like 1909.
Okay. Let's go back.
Well, we only have about a minute and a half now.
Then let me do the talk, and a minute and a half I'll finish. Before the turn of the last century, almost all taxes were levied by states. The churches had never been taxed. It started with churches, property belonging to churches, libraries, but all of this was state law. It was not until 1895, something in that era, when the federal government first mentioned charitable organizations. They didn't call them nonprofits. Charitable organizations. They were exempted. Then later it was codified that they had to be nonprofit. It was charitable organization first, then nonprofit.
Mm-hmm.
What we think of today with the whole tax law set up with the 501Cs, that did not happen until 1954. And they were not in those days 29 categories of 501C. But just to let, again, your listeners understand, what we have today in terms of the tax exemptions. Number one, this goes back centuries. Number two, it started with the states. Number three, it became the law of the land when the feds put it in right around World War I. The exemption, the personal exemption for giving a deduction,
the charitable deduction, yeah,
goes back to the World War I era.
Okay.
So, again, everything we see today, Tony, has roots a long time ago, and that's the overall theme of this particular part of the book that I'm working on.
Outstanding. We look forward to the book. When it comes out, we'll talk more.
I'll be back.
Okay. Sounds like Charity Navigator between on the bookshelf. Dr. Robert Penna, you'll find him at outcomestoolbox.com. Thank you again, Bob.
Thank you for having me.
Future of Email is coming up. No, Future of Email is not coming up. Who writes this copy? New Overtime Rules with Gene Takagi is coming up. All right. What I need, you've heard me say this before, I need an intern so that I have somebody to blame for this crappy copy. So if you have, if you are interested in being an intern, I don't know, or if you have a son or daughter and you don't mind them being blamed for my mistakes, send me their resume, tony@tonymartinetti.com. New Overtime Rules with Gene Takagi. That's what's coming up. First, Pursuant. There's an opportunity for you to join a groundbreaking panel to raise the bar for U.S. fundraising. Pursuant is partnered with Roger, which is a fundraising think tank in England. Dr. Adrian Sargent was a guest maybe 4, 5, 6 weeks ago, roughly, from Roger. To bring this joint venture is to bring what's called critical fundraising to the U.S. And they are recruiting a panel of pro fundraisers to make sure that new ideas come out of Roger's research, like the relationship fundraising study that Dr. Sargent and I talked about. That was the March 18th show. So it was more than 6 weeks ago, March 18th. So they want to put this, you know, this thought into practice, and that's why they are recruiting a panel, and also help the two companies identify. Well, one's a company, one's a think tank. Let's be precise now. Identify gaps in fundraising knowledge so that Roger can research them and fill them in. And you know, I keep saying Roger. I don't know if it's Rogare, but that's the Latin that it comes from, which is to ask. I don't know if over there they're pronouncing it Roger or Rogare, but in any case, they're partnered with Pursuant. You can join the panel. The deadline to apply to be a panel member is July 1st. So you still have about a week. Go to tony.me/pursuantroger, R-O-G-A-R-E. And you have to put a capital P and you have to put a capital R because that's the way Bitly works. So tony.me/pursuantroger. And get your application in before July 1st. Hopefully you will be on the panel and improve fundraising practice in the U.S. That's the whole purpose of this. Now, Tony's Take Two. Fundraising Fundamentals. It's the podcast that I produce for the Chronicle of Philanthropy. Been doing this for 3 or 4 years. You know that part. I put together a roundup of shows that are excellent that I think deserve your attention. There's one on donor empathy called Put Yourself in Your Donor's Shoes. Ideas for Giving Tuesday. There's ideas for boosting your planned giving, and there's more. Now, this is a short form fundraising fundamentals. It's only, each one is about 10 minutes. So I could never squeeze Dr. Penna into fundraising fundamentals. It wouldn't work. He's still here, so I'm not saying anything behind his back. Anyway, I did a roundup. The video and the links to those short episodes of fundraising fundamentals are at tonymartinetti.com. And that is Tony's Take Two. Gene Takagi, I know he's on the phone, and you know who he is. He is the managing attorney at NEO, the Nonprofit and Exempt Organizations Law Group. He's our monthly legal contributor, times many, many years. He edits the popular blog at nonprofitlawblog.com, and on Twitter, he is at GTAK, G-T-A-K. Welcome back, Gene Takagi.
Thanks, Tony. Happy summer.
Oh, cool. Happy summer to you, too. It's a sweltering one here in Washington, I almost said. New York City, it's mid-80s. What's it like in San Francisco?
It's actually a pretty comfortable, like, 72 out here.
Yeah, big deal. All right. San Francisco is always bragging about their weather. Yeah, I don't know. You're always boasting about that. Not in June, though. You have June gloom. Did you have fog earlier today, June gloom?
We've had some June gloom, but yes. We're headed towards July and the sweet weather now.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we'll worry about that. All right. Another time. All right. Overtime rules. Overtime rules have changed, Gene, and it takes effect December 1st, so there's still time to plan, but this has some serious implications for nonprofits.
It does, and I think most of us are sort of generally aware of overtime rules. I don't know if you've had hourly jobs before like I have, Tony, but you know, we sort of get used to that idea of if we've worked more than 40 hours per week as an hourly employee, we're entitled to overtime, time and a half. And so I remember being an hourly worker, that was actually sometimes a great thing to have, to have that extra income.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what's less known is that even if you're paid a salary, and so let's say you're paid, you know, $30,000 per year or something and not on an hourly basis, you might still have the right to overtime if you work more than 40 hours per week. That's sometimes little known and little understood both by employees and employers. And you know, generally, the way people think is that salaried employees, if you get a salary and not an hourly wage, you're kind of in that category of exempt employees, which are those who are exempt from the overtime pay.
Right, but not all. Yeah.
Right. And sort of the most common forms of exemption are referred to as the white-collar exemption. I mean, those are the executives who are, you know, usually managers managing two or more employees, the professionals who are like, you know, teachers, lawyers, and doctors, and usually it requires a degree and some sort of certificate or license. And the administrative employees that are performing office and non-manual work that's directly related to management or general business operations. So those are the typical salaried exceptions, the white-collar exemptions from overtime.
Okay, wait, Gene, let's acquaint listeners and me with what's changed. Let's not bury the headline. What is new about overtime?
So what is new is those white-collar exemptions were subject to a minimum amount. So even if you fall under the definitions of executive professional or administrative professional, if you were making less than $23,660, which is currently the threshold, you were entitled to get overtime if you worked more than 40 hours. So that's what's little known. If you made less than $23,660, you were entitled to overtime even if you were salaried.
Mm.
Now, the law that's changing says that minimum threshold is going up by more than double. So the new threshold is going to be $47,476.
Right.
So more than $47,000, yeah. Where the old threshold, which will apply until December 1st, is only $23,000.
So many more people now eligible for overtime pay.
Right. So basically, everybody who was salaried between $23,660 and $47,476 are entitled will be entitled to overtime pay, time and a half based on their salary, starting December 1st.
And how do you calculate what is the hourly rate? You divide the weekly salary by 40?
Yeah, I think you're just going to do it on a pro rata basis. So you can divide it by the number of hours that you work in a year for a worker, and then that's the hourly rate, and you times it by time and a half.
Okay. Now, this applies to all employers, right? This is not just nonprofits that are being hit.
Yeah, it applies not to all employers, but nonprofits don't have a special exclusion from this.
Okay,
yeah.
No special exclusion for nonprofits. And it comes from the U.S. Department of Labor.
That's absolutely right.
This is not California law now. This is not,
right.
For once, it's not California.
But people should know that they need to look at their state laws, because the state laws sometimes might be even more strict than the federal laws. In some ways, that can be more difficult for employers, and in some ways, this increase will be much, much less for state law. Under state law, in California, for example, our current minimum for exempt employees is $41,000, so the jump to $47,000 isn't so big. The federal level is jumping from $23,000 to $47,000, a much, much higher increase affecting many, many more employers and employees.
Are there any states going above the $47,476?
None that I know of.
Okay. No, none being more generous. All right.
Right.
But I understand the importance. You do need to check your own state law.
Yeah, and California will probably be over that amount in a few years, as they're targeting a $15 minimum salary, hourly rate, and the exempt categories will go up with that over a number of years.
All right. You said no special exemption for nonprofits, but some nonprofits are accepted. No umbrella exemption for nonprofits, but there are some accepted nonprofit categories.
Yeah, so nonprofits, so generally you can fall under the coverage in three ways. And one way is just by operation of state law. So I'm going to leave that out for now, because the states will all differ on that. But the two other main ways to get covered is, one, if the nonprofit is considered a covered enterprise. So a little bit of jargon there, but
yes.
Generally that means one of two things. One is that they're one of these named enterprises. So if it's a hospital or an organization that takes care of older adults or people with disabilities who reside on the organization's premises, or schools for children who are mentally or physically disabled or gifted, preschools, elementary schools, secondary schools, and colleges and universities, all covered. So all their employees are covered as well. The other type of nonprofit that would be covered.
Okay, right. I need to understand something. Covered means they're subject to this rule, or they are
not?
That's right. They are subject to the new law.
Right. So employees of all of those named enterprises are going to be subject to those new rules and the new threshold for overtime pay.
Okay, so those are categories named enterprises.
Right.
All right. So you still might be outside the named enterprises.
Absolutely.
Okay.
So most nonprofits are probably not just in those strict categories,
right,
of hospitals and schools and things.
Right.
So the other way you get covered is if you have ordinary commercial activities that result in sales or business done of at least $500,000. So the trick here is it's commercial activities. So they're not talking about donations, and they're not talking about income that's directly related to furthering your charitable purpose. They're talking about commercial activities that are more like unrelated business activities.
Yeah.
So if you've got that type of commercial activity, and I should say that commercial activity and unrelated business activity under the tax code with unrelated business income tax, they're defined slightly differently. So I'll just say this is more broader. So if it's a commercial type activity that's being done for profit, and you're intending to run a business to generate income for the nonprofit, no,
yeah,
matter where the profits go, you're just running a real business.
Uh-huh.
And if it's you're making at least $500,000 on it, then you may be a covered enterprise, and then all of these the new thresholds for the overtime are going to apply to your
right
organization's
so
employees.
So still a lot of charitable organizations that are not covered yet, but because based on what we're going through, because you have
right
you have the named enterprises, the covered enterprises, the named ones. You got the $500,000 threshold in commercial activity. If you're over that in commercial activity, then these new rules apply to you. But we're still talking about a lot of charities that are not going to be impacted.
Not yet.
Okay,
so
let's keep going.
Here's this other category.
All right.
So any nonprofit who has employees who are engaged in interstate commerce, so that's business transactions basically between or amongst different states, including whether you're on the phone or whether you're doing business, not on a very, very rare basis, but somewhat regularly, interacting with folks or businesses or other organizations across state lines.
Now, does that include fundraising activity?
Yeah, that could.
Well, this is a close one now because
commerce,
this
so
is
it's not going to just be donations there. So it's beyond just simple fundraising.
It's beyond. Okay, and now I'm putting you on the spot. So if you can't say definitively, you know, of course, you know, use your lawyerly skills to qualify, but this is going to be the biggest one that would potentially, that's why I'm asking the question, sweep lots of nonprofits in. If I'm a California charity and I'm making calls to Nevada for fundraising or sending emails or any of these other things that are solicitations, which you and I have talked about when you get into that whole charity solicitation registration realm, if you're doing these things across state lines, is that the kind of activity that you're talking about?
Yeah, if you do it on a fairly regular basis, that could be activity that we're talking about.
Okay. That's a big category
also,
then.
If you're looking for donated items that are going to cross state lines, that may be what we're talking about as well. So any movement of persons or things, including donated goods across state lines, that's going to trigger. And just the employees who are engaged in that activity, that doesn't cover all of the nonprofit's employees. It's just the employees that are engaged in that particular activity.
Okay. So most likely this is going to be your fundraising team if you're going across state lines. And, you know, depending how big you are, you might have a corporate sponsorship team that just does that. Crowdfunding is going to be implicated, right?
Yeah, it could be. We're not really sure. Crowdfunding is so new and not really caught into how the rest of the laws are thinking about interstate commerce, and I don't exactly know how that will work, especially with different intermediaries that help out in the crowdfunding process.
Okay. Yes, those platforms as well. All right, Gene, let's go out for a break. When we come back, of course, we'll keep talking about this, and I know you have some ideas for what nonprofits need to do, and also coming up, live listener love. Stay with us.
Like what you're hearing on Nonprofit Radio? Tony's got more. On YouTube, you'll find clips from his stand-up comedy, TV spots, and exclusive interviews. Catch guests like Seth Godin, Craig Newmark, the founder of Craigslist, Mark Echo of Echo Enterprises, Charles Best from DonorsChoose.org, Aria Finger of DoSomething.org, and Naomi Levine from New York University's Hyman Center on Philanthropy. Tony tweets, too. He finds the best content from the most knowledgeable and interesting people in and around nonprofits to share on his stream. If you have valuable info, he wants to retweet you. During the show, you can join the conversation on Twitter using hashtag Nonprofit Radio. Twitter is an easy way to reach Tony. He's at Tony Martinetti, MARTIGNETTI. Remember, there's a G before the N. He hosts a podcast for the Chronicle of Philanthropy. Fundraising Fundamentals is a short, monthly show devoted to getting you over your fundraising hurdles. Just like Nonprofit Radio, Tony talks to leading thinkers, experts, and cool people with great ideas. As one fan said, Tony picks their brains and I don't have to leave my office. Fundraising Fundamentals was recently dubbed the most helpful nonprofit podcast you have ever heard. You can also join the conversation on Facebook, where you can ask questions before or after the show. The guests are there too. Get insider show alerts by email. Tony tells you who's on each week and always includes links so that you can contact guests directly. To sign up, visit the Facebook page or TonyMartinetti.com.
I'm Jonah Halper, author of Date Your Donors, and you're listening to Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio, big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%.
Welcome back. Live listener love, as promised. Oh my goodness, we're gushing. San Jose, California. Stamford, Connecticut. South Boundbrook, New Jersey. Love it. Welcome, South Boundbrook. Morristown, New Jersey. Live listener love to you. Boston, Mass. Talking all about New England today with Bob Penna. Rockford, Illinois. Live listener love. I think that's is that most of the domestic. Oh, St. Louis, Missouri was early on. Live listener love. So grateful to have that many live listeners. The love goes out to you, of course. We got to go abroad. I would be remiss if we don't. I have to do it. Tokyo, Japan. Three different listeners in Japan, in Tokyo specifically. Konnichiwa. We have three listeners in Seoul, South Korea. Annyeonghaseyo. A lot of times we can't see just how many. We just know it's multiple, but you see three today. And also multiple from Tehran, Iran. Welcome. Live listener love to Tehran. Three listeners there also. Love it. Love it. My voice cracked a little bit. Malaysia, we can't see your city. I'm sorry, but we know you're with us. Live listener love to you. And we got any other? Let's see. Oh, yeah, of course. Hasselby, Sweden. Welcome. Live listener love. And Noble Park, Australia. Live listener love to you also. I believe that is all the. Yes. If we didn't shout you out, then I'm sorry. But live love. Live love to the live listeners. Absolutely. Podcast Pleasantries. You know how many you are, well over 10,000 of you listening, whatever it is you're doing. You get tired of me enumerating the activities that I've heard. So just simple pleasantries to the over 10,000 podcast listeners, the vast majority of our audience. And the affiliate affections, got to send that out to our AM and FM listeners throughout the country, our affiliate stations. Let your station know that you listen to Nonprofit Radio. They would love that feedback. I would be grateful. Thank you very much, AM and FM affiliate listeners. Gene Takagi, thank you for that indulgence. Thank you for being on the phone with me while I thank all our listeners. It's important. It's important.
It's so impressive, the international scope of your listeners.
It is. It's cool. Did you, now I don't know if you were listening earlier today, did you catch our listener of the week at the top of the show, the executive director of California Symphony?
I did not. I'm sorry I missed that.
That's okay. Aubrey Bergauer. Do you, I don't know, do you patronize California Symphony?
I patronize symphonies in California.
Okay. Well, hopefully Audrey's not listening any longer. Okay. Let's see. So we have, we have our standard like 5 minutes or so left. What are some things that nonprofits should be looking at doing to make sure that they are in compliance come December 1st?
Sure. And so, first of all, make sure you check to see whether you're covered or not. And the one broad category that I just referred to very offhandedly was coverage through state law. And note that there's the National Council of Nonprofits says that in at least 11 states, including New York and New Jersey, the federal rules will apply to virtually all employees and employers including of nonprofits. So watch your state law coverage as well, wow, in addition to the different coverages we talked about.
Can you, Gene, can you name any of the other states in that 11?
According to them, it was Alaska, D.C., Illinois, Maine, Maryland, Massachusetts, Missouri, New Jersey, and New York, as I said, North Carolina, and Ohio.
Okay, and the National Association of Nonprofits believes most of the nonprofits, most or all nonprofits in those states will be covered by this?
Yeah. It says,
subject to this?
By operation of state law or regulation or administrative ruling will automatically apply to virtually all employees and employers.
Okay. Thank you very much for that enumeration.
Sure.
All right. So you got to know if you're subject to it. Then what if you are?
Well, then you've got to do a lot of planning, right? So if you're going to be subject to it, then you got to start managing and figuring out your budget. And what's so difficult about this is it starts in December, so not too many people are going to have a chance to react to this with their next year's budget. They're going to have to figure out how this is going to impact this year's budget. And so then they'll have to figure out, well, what do we do? Do we regularly use overtime, first of all, and are our employees covered? And are we going to have to find different alternatives? Do we need to maybe hire part-time employees or spread out the work in a different manner so we discourage or lessen our need to give overtime pay? Or do we provide pay raises that increase the workers' salaries to the new threshold so we are sort of in sync overall, and we don't have to pay overtime if we can get them up to that new threshold? And if they're very close to it, that might be a cost savings.
Right. So one of those is heartless, and the other is altruistic. If we start cutting workers, reducing them to part-time, that's bad for them.
Oh, actually, what I was suggesting, and you know, there's good and bad to all of this, but what I was first suggesting is hire part-time employees, new employees, so your current employees don't have to work the overtime.
Oh, hire new employees. Okay. I was thinking reducing current employees to part-time and bringing on more.
Yeah, so what the critics are going to say, though, is that may not happen, but what may happen is that with the increased costs that are going to result because of the additional overtime pay some nonprofits are going to have to pay starting in December, they may just lay off workers or cut programs instead.
Yeah.
And that's the scary thought.
Has that, I'm sure somebody has raised that doomsday scenario.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I'm not sure how you feel about it. You know, without having had a chance to sort of really study it, but there were over 200,000 comments that were sent when they first proposed these regulations to the Department of Labor. Most of them were pretty negative, and a lot of those negative comments came from nonprofits that were saying, you know, first of all, we had no chance to really react because the rules come in place so quickly by December, we didn't really account for different geographic, cost of living issues. So, you know, making, you know, that amount, $47,000 in New York is probably one thing, or San Francisco, and making it in Oklahoma City or somewhere else may be very, very different. So there's some really good criticisms about it and some difficulties some nonprofits, especially in those rural areas, that are going to have to face. On the other hand, there are people that say, you know, we shouldn't be taking advantage of workers just because we're a nonprofit organization and paying them at a rate that's below poverty level for a family of four. And that was the reason why the administration had justified that shift. It had not been changed since 2004.
So where the $23,000 is below the poverty level for
a
family of four?
Yeah, in fact, I think the $23,000 is well below poverty level for a family of four. So that's assuming one person making the income for that family.
Okay. And where does the new 46 or 47 fit? Where's that in respect to the poverty level? Do you know?
Well, this is how they defined it. So I'm not exactly sure how they compare it exactly to where the poverty level is defined, but they say it represents the 40th percentile of earnings, the 40 out of 100.
40th percentile, that's not very high.
Yeah, of full-time salaried workers in the lowest wage census region, which is the South. So 40th percentile of full-time salaried workers, that's 47,000.
In a place where the cost of living is
the
lower,
lowest, right?
Is the lowest, in the South, okay. All right. Well, we got to take these things maybe incrementally, but it definitely, you know, it's, yeah, it, mean, it has budget impact. And, you know, I'm not surprised that a lot of the comments from nonprofits were negative. This it's going to cost.
Yeah, it's definitely going to cost, and it's going to hurt some people in services. Maybe the counter is sometimes you're going to have to take some steps back as on an organizational level. So on a national or broader level, we're moving forward.
All right, Gene, we're going to leave it there. I want to thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Tony.
My pleasure, as always. Gene Takagi, you'll find him at nonprofitlawblog.com and also at GTAC. Next week, purpose-driven branding and the new GuideStar Platinum. If you missed any part of today's show, I beseech you, find it on TonyMartinetti.com. We're sponsored by Pursuant, online tools for small and mid-sized nonprofits, data-driven and technology-enabled, Pursuant.com. Remember to check out the 300th show. I hope you're going to be with us July 29th. You can play the music, Sam. Go ahead. Don't be shy. July 29th, 300th show, 6th anniversary. Our creative producer is Claire Meyerhoff. Sam Liebowitz is the line producer. Gavin Dahl is our AM and FM outreach director. The show's social media is by Susan Chavez, and this music is by Scott Stein. Be with me next week for Nonprofit Radio. Big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. Go out and be great.
What's not to love about Nonprofit Radio? Tony gets the best guests. Check this out from Seth Godin.
This is the first revolution since TV 1950 and Henry Ford 1920. It's the revolution of our lifetime.
Here's a smart, simple idea from Craigslist founder Craig Newmark.
Yeah, in sites or in presentation or anything, people don't really need the fancy stuff. They need something which is simple and fast.
When's the best time to post on Facebook? Facebook's Andrew Noyes knows.
At traffic is at an all-time high around 9 a.m. or 8 p.m. So that's when you should be posting your most meaningful posts.
Here's Aria Finger, COO of DoSomething.org.
Young people are not going to be involved in social change if it's boring and they don't see the impact of what they're doing. So you got to make it fun and applicable to these young people, because otherwise a 15 and 16-year-old, they have better things to do. They have Xbox, they have TV, they have their cell phones.
Ami Dar is the founder of Idealist.
It took 2 or 3 years for foundation staff to sort of deign to add an email address to their card. It was phone. This email thing is weird. And plus, why should I give it away?
Charles Best founded DonorsChoose.org.
Somehow they've gotten in touch, kind of offline, as it were.
Yeah.
And they'll do exchanges of brownies and visits and physical gift.
Mark Echo is the founder and CEO of Echo Enterprises. You may be wearing his hoodies and shirts. Tony talked to him.
Yeah, you know, I'm a big believer that it's not what you make in life. It's you know, it's how you make people feel.
This is public radio host Majora Carter.
Innovation is in the power of understanding that you don't just, you know, just put money on a situation and expect it to heal. You put money on a situation and invest it and expect it to grow.
And savvy advice for success from Eric Saperston.
What separates those who achieve from those who do not is in direct proportion to one's ability to ask others for help.
The smartest experts and leading thinkers are on Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio. Big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%.